I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Most Americans take the measure of the country by the gross domestic product, GDP, the measure of the market value of all goods produced. But how much does GDP actually tell us about the country's well-being? Greg Cantore would say, not much. He's one of the TEDx Baltimore speakers this weekend at Morgan State University, and one of three we'll hear from this hour of Midday. We'll also speak with Julia Machari Alexander, head of the Walters Art Museum, about reimagining the museum experience. And Shanaisha Sauls, chairwoman of the Baltimore City School Board, who asks, what if public schools worked like startups? An hour with three TEDx speakers next on Midday, after the news from NPR. And welcome to Midday, everyone. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanking you again for making our show part of your radio listening day at WYPR, WYPF, WYPO, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. In the second hour of our show today, Chris Taylor is a pretty well-known guy from Mashable, the news website. He's deputy editor there. Has written a book about Star Wars, the Star Wars franchise, the business of Star Wars, how the first film got made, what the franchise is worth, what has happened to it over all these years, 37 years, 38 years since the first Star Wars film. Chris Taylor will be joining us in the second hour of our show today. He's written a book about Star Wars, a history, how Star Wars conquered the universe, the past, present, and the future of a multi-billion dollar franchise said to be worth something like $40 billion these days. Income inequality, the cost of crime, the cost of underemployment, the cost of air and water pollution. Imagine if these costs factored into how we gauge the country's well-being. We're so used to hearing about gross domestic product or the value of produced goods as a way to measure the nation's status, but there are some who say that GDP doesn't give us the whole picture. Instead, they advocate for the use of GPI, or Genuine Progress Indicator, as the country's barometer. Maryland is one of only a handful of states that actually uses the GPI. A little later in the show, we'll hear from Greg Cantore, until recently the head of Maryland Nonprofits, who advocates for its universal adoption of the GPI. During this hour of our show, we're presenting the ideas of three speakers who will be appearing at the upcoming TEDx Baltimore event that's happening Friday at Morgan State University. We'll tell you about the event a little bit later on in the show. The TEDx will feature 16 different speakers, and at the end of the hour, as I said, I'll give you some information about tickets. On Midday today, as I said, we'll hear from Greg Cantore a little bit later. We'll also hear from TEDx Baltimore speaker Shanaisha Sauls, who is chair of the Baltimore City School Board. But up front, we welcome onto the show Julia Machari Alexander, Executive Director of the Walters Art Museum, also one of the TEDx speakers. It's a pleasure to get to meet you, Julia.
Well, I'm so thrilled to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
You've been at the Walters now for a couple of years. You came here from San Diego, worked in the museum there.
That's right.
Yeah. What do you think of the Walters Art Museum?
I mean, love it.
I mean, it's kind of a, if you were just a spectator walking through, what would you say about it?
It's one of the great art museums of the world. And it's right here in Baltimore, and we have the luxury not only of having one of the great art museums of the world, but two, with the Baltimore Museum of Art as well.
What do you like most about the Walters? What's the one thing in there that stuck out to you over the last 2 years?
It's the intimacy of it. It's not a place where you go and you see great big giant things. You really have small moments of encounter with lots of beautiful, unique objects that are not necessarily the kind of things you expect to see in a museum. For instance, we have a lot of jewelry.
Yeah, that's right.
And so you can have a moment of wonder with something quite small, and also we have some large paintings as well. So it's the intimacy of it.
You got recruited to do a TEDx.
I did.
Yeah. What did you think of this when it was first proposed?
Fear.
Yeah. What? Really? Because you're on a stage for 15 minutes, right?
You are. And the idea is supposed to be big, and it's supposed to be kind of controversial, and it's supposed to be really thought-provoking. And I don't think that museums come to mind when people first think about them as something that is thought-provoking. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about that, and I'm interested in that idea.
So this, you're sort of forced into thinking of a big idea.
Exactly. Yeah.
So what did you come up with? I have here a note that says the museum as a super collider. Is that actually the title of your TEDx?
That is. That is. And I'm dating myself because I think for my, you know, people who were coming of age or in the beginning of their adulthood in the early 90s and 2000s, the Super Collider was sort of everywhere. You know, Radiohead's got a song called Super Collider. I think it's Metallica has Super Collider on their album covers. So the Super Collider was in the moment. And it was right in that moment that the one in Waxahachie, Texas, was being funded by the U.S. government. And then it was just too big. And even though some things are too big to fail, that failed. And it's just sitting there now.
Right.
So I thought about the Super Collider.
It's a museum piece.
Right, exactly. But the reason I was thinking about a Super Collider is that it's, you know, the TEDx idea and the theme around this conference is collisions. And what happens in a Super Collider is that they shoot beams of particles through extremely big spaces. And then in four places in that circular light beam, there are intersections, and it's through those collisions of particles that we discover substantial and really material facts about the universe and about us. So it's about collisions.
I didn't mention that, the TEDx Baltimore theme is collisions. It's large letters there on the front of their website. So right. You were told that going in here.
We were, but we weren't told that we had to choose topics around that. Mm-hmm. But I've been really thinking about the idea of what is the museum in the 21st century? How should we be talking about it? You know, different people. What do you, Dan, think about when you think about a museum?
I find it to be thought-provoking. I like to walk through a museum, and if something catches my eye, maybe read about it, sit and ponder it a little bit. I like to think of things that ancient people held in their hands. I'm sort of fascinated with that. I like to stand back 30, 40 feet from a painting I like and try to figure out what's going on there. I spend a lot of time. I don't run through or rush through museums much. I take my time and have a sort of like you, the word you use, intimate moment with a museum piece.
Right, what you're describing are encounters.
Yeah.
So you have a moment of coming together with something or some things from the past. And I began coming to this topic by thinking about us as a kind of time machine. I had to explain to a group of little six-year-olds in West Baltimore what I do. And I said, I work in a modern-day time machine because you can travel backwards and forwards to antiquity. In fact, you've just mentioned your encounter with an object from antiquity. It's something that was held by someone 2,500 years ago. And so how can that help us understand the moment that we're in? This isn't just about putting up on pedestals, literally, great works of art that we need to admire simply because they are beautiful or simply because they're amazing technically. But what did they mean in their time? What were people interested in the time in which they were made? Then I like to think of what 100 years later were people interested in? Why is this still here? What happened 100 years afterwards that made it so interesting that we still have it now 300 years later? And then what I've really begun to think about, and this is where I end my TED Talk, I'm not going to give it away, but in fact, in the last hour, we were hearing about iconoclasm and the role that imagery plays in some of the moments of extremism that we are in right now. And so if you think about the museum as the place where we can talk about even something as vast as the history of extremism, I think that we can do that in a safe place. So like the Super Collider, which is the largest place on Earth that you need to have large in order to create the collision of the very smallest things we know. I mean, that issue of scale. And that's in a controlled environment. That's what I think the museum can do for us as humans in our moment.
When people think of the future, TED Talks is all about, well, it's not all about, but it's often about what the future might look like, what your vision is, what the speaker's vision is for something. They think of technology when they think of the future. So have you thought about
Exactly.
Technology's role in the museum experience when you reimagine the museum experience?
I do. I think about it all the time, really, because really what art is, it's technology of its time. So the craftsmanship that goes into an object itself is also using the best technology of the time to create something really beautiful. So it's not just the tools through which we can discover these objects. So in other words, looking through your iPhone or, you know, looking at taking a mobile site tour, which we're just launching at the Walters. But it's also thinking about the objects themselves as icons of their own moments of technology and technological invention. And that's actually something that we can do at the Walters in a way that other museums can't because of the objects that we have in our collection.
Because it's so diverse.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so how do you get people to think this way, though, about their museum visit?
Well, I think we need to start talking about the museum as a place where you can come and have an encounter, and it doesn't have to be one type of encounter. So if you are interested in technology, come and see what we do with technology, but also come and explore the history of technology. And you bring your own experiences. One of the things that I'm really keen on is not saying you're going to come to the museum and you're going to learn what I have to teach you. It's much more about that collision, that moment of encounter. It's about what happens with you individually. I started asking what happened with you individually. Well, if I know why you come to the museum, Dan, I can tailor what we do together when we're there in a way that's more interesting to you.
How do you tailor future exhibits in this way? Is this a matter of marketing, advertising, you know, explaining this to people? So they relate to the Walters in a different way?
Part of it is listening to what people say about us and then trying to figure out how we can work with people to see us in a different way. One thing that we have found out is that most people, when they think about a museum, is they think about their sixth grade field trip in, you know, frankly, 1935, 1965, 1985.
Right.
The difference between the field trip that the kids take now and the field trip that I had in 1975 is enormous. It's not Charlie Brown's teacher, right?
right.
It's a much more interactive experience where we listen to the kids and think about how we can teach them through conversation as opposed to just teach them through lecturing.
Well, good luck with your TED Talk.
Oh, well, thank you.
A little tryout here with questions.
I know.
Fortunately, I won't be there on Friday asking you questions in the middle of your TED Talk.
Well, I hope that...
You get to roll for 15 minutes, right?
Exactly. I think so, but I'll miss you.
All right. Well, thank you. It was nice to meet you finally.
It's great to meet you and see you at the Walters, I hope.
Okay. Yes. By the way, you might as well mention hours and, you know...
Great.
And actually, the basic logistics of the Walters for people.
So we're open Wednesday through Sunday, 10 to 5. And on Thursday evenings, our most exciting evenings, we are open from 5 to 9, and we have lots of activities. But upcoming February 6th to 8th, we have technology. We have a thing we do called Art Bites, where we invite the most exciting technologists to come in and play with the collection and create great things.
So you're already doing a little bit of what you just were talking about.
Exactly. So next week, come by and see what they're doing.
Art Bites. Very good. Julia Machari-Alexander is Executive Director of the Walters Art Museum in Baltimore. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Dan.
When we come back, we'll meet another speaker from TED Talks Baltimore. Up next, Greg Cantori, former head of Maryland Nonprofits, talking about the genuine progress indicator to gauge the country's well-being. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. This hour, we're bringing you ideas from three Baltimore TEDx speakers ahead of the TEDx event, which is Friday at Morgan State University. Let's see. Greg Cantori's up next. Greg Cantori will be speaking about the genuine progress indicator versus the gross domestic product versus using the GDP as a measure of the country's well-being. Hello, Greg.
Hey, Dan.
Nice to have you on the show with us.
It's great to be here today. It really is.
Until recently, you were head of Maryland Nonprofits, which is the what?
Where the I'm umbrella?
I'm using my arms.
He's waving in the air.
It looks like a big umbrella, doesn't it? Yeah.
That's right. Umbrella organization. So we are the Association of the Nonprofits in Maryland, and we represent all 32,000 nonprofits in Maryland and have well over 1,000 members currently paid.
So you retired?
I am retired at this point.
Yeah?
Yeah. Long sabbatical.
What got you thinking about this GPI? I guess we ought to first describe what it is, and then
sure.
Tell us.
Begin with the piece of what a GDP is. That's a we have in our lingo TLAs, three letter acronyms. We throw them around all the time, right? Three letters. So you got GPI, GDP, and so on.
TLAs.
So yes, this is another one. But GDP was created in 1934, right after the Great Depression. And it was created because we had no real metric on how our country was doing economically at that time. So an economist was asked to go ahead and put this together, and he did a lot of research, and it came out to a very simple math, actually. It's simply all the goods and services combined that our country produces throughout the year, and that's GDP. And we've been using that now for the last 80 years.
So it's about productivity.
Productivity, that's correct. And he even said when he created this, please do not use this as a metric of our well-being.
He actually said that to Congress, whoever he did this for.
He did. He was very insightful because he realized that this was a blunt instrument and a single metric. And when he put this together, he was very concerned that we would use this as, unfortunately, we're using it now, which is an indicator, supposedly, of our standard of living and our well-being, which it's not.
Who uses it? The government uses it. Researchers use it.
Everybody uses it.
It's used globally.
You bet. This is how we compare countries. And we will say things like, the GDP of China versus the United States. We use it all the time to compare countries. States, we have something called GSP, another TLA. That's the gross state product. Mm-hmm. And we use that to compare our state versus other states.
We've used that in Maryland.
That's correct. And so all of the states use that. And of course, there's even within the cities, there's economic activity that gets measured and put out there. The problem is again, this is only a single metric. And our lives are much more complex than a single metric. And that's where the problem lies.
And the GPI, how long has this been around?
Well, GPI has been around, about 15 years now. And it was percolating up. It was created combination of efforts of the Gund Institute up in Vermont, as well as University of Maryland, the Institute for Policy Studies, went ahead and coordinated on that. And they also got a lot of help from a really great group called the Happy Planet Index. That kind of tells you all the way what this is all about. It's about our sense of well-being, our sense of happiness. And the Happy Planet Index had already done a lot of research and they have three specific metrics that they put together. And they're actually able to measure the countries based on the Happy Planet Index criteria. And who do you think is number one right now in the world in terms of happy?
One of those Nordic countries.
I thought so too, yeah. Actually. That was a good guess. That was a good guess.
Maybe someplace where you can smoke marijuana legally. I don't know.
That was a good guess. But no, actually, it's really amazing. The top 10 countries, eight of the top 10 countries are in Latin America, South America, and Central America. And South Central.
Under this measure.
Happy and number one is
the GPI measure?
Yeah, they call it Happy Planet Index.
Happy Planet Index.
And number one right now is Costa Rica.
Hmm.
Number three is Colombia.
What goes into the Happy Planet Index?
They have three.
I assume it's similar to the GPI.
It's got some similar pieces. It's basically about your sense of well-being, your sense of economic security on that, and then also the ecological footprint. How much of all of the activities that we're doing this is either harming or helping the environment? And so those are put together.
Some of that sounds like a survey question.
That's
like
correct.
You have to ask people how they feel about life these days,
Dan,
right?
You just nailed it. This is the criticism of these indexes is that there's some subjectivity built into it. So let's move to the GPI, which is something that was created more locally. And Maryland is the very first state to have adopted the GPI as a metric.
The state officially adopted this?
That's correct.
Was that an act of the legislature or
no,
the governor?
It was actually an act of the governor. O'Malley.
Hmm.
And it's currently up there. And it's been sitting very quietly, frankly, for the last 3 or 4 years. And it has 26 criteria right now, 26 that are really well-measured metrics. I mean, these are ones that are pretty unimpeachable in terms of where that information comes from. And each of those metrics is at least 20 to 30 years worth of data.
Wow. So give us an idea of what you're talking about. So this isn't from a subjective survey.
No.
Asking people about their mood.
No.
you know, how they do last year and all that kind of stuff. Good.
Yeah.
And why don't we list some of these for people?
So some of these, so just give you an idea here. And let me actually put this back in context. We just talked about the GDP being all the goods and services. The GPI is actually related to the GDP, but it subtracts the negative activities that we do, as well as adding positive ones the GDP doesn't count. Let's talk about some of the positive ones on here. For instance, the value of volunteer work, one of my favorites as a nonprofit tier.
That's under social indicators.
So
by the
way,
there's three categories: economic indicators, which you would expect,
right,
environmental indicators, and social indicators, and the one you just mentioned is value of volunteer work.
That's right.
Now, how does someone measure that?
Well, we actually have, and all the states do, an hourly rate for volunteers. And like YPR and all the other nonprofits out there who have volunteers involved, they're providing value to these nonprofits, to our society, to our quality of life. But the GDP doesn't count that.
How do you measure that, though?
Oh, it's an hourly rate. So what they do is they have, every year they come up with a calculation of what would an average volunteer be paid if they were being paid.
I see. And so this nonprofit, WYPR and others, report to Maryland nonprofits?
An estimate based on the number of volunteers that have reported out there. Volunteer Maryland does a lot of this tracking here.
That's
the Governor's
collects,
Office of Volunteerism.
That's who collects the
information. That's
okay.
Right. So that's just one quick positive. And then there's some others on there. The value of higher education. So once somebody gets their degree, there's a tremendous echo effect in terms of the benefits to society, the benefits. But that doesn't get counted in GDP.
All right, slow down. Let me ask you about value of higher education. So they're looking at the number of people who have advanced degrees?
That's right.
Beyond high school?
That's right.
Okay, and it's as simple as that.
That's as simple
as
that.
The total in the population with college degrees.
That's right. And another, let me add one more positive, is the value of housework. So individuals who stay home to take care of the children, who basically manage the affairs of the house and so on, that does not get counted under GDP. Yet that's a tremendous value. Think about that in terms of the value to the children growing up and so on. But that doesn't get counted as under GDP.
There's some other interesting line items under social indicators. Cost of crime. So you do calculate using the negative impact, right?
That's right.
The cost of crime. The cost of lost leisure time.
That's a huge one.
What is the lost leisure time? I'm trying to think. I probably have a lot of that.
Well, but, we're notorious.
I slept through most of my leisure time. Is that a loss? I don't know.
Well, no. The United States, we're notorious for not being vacation takers, even when it's offered, because we're fearful right now of losing our jobs or looking like we're slackers at work.
So how do they come up with that one, cost of lost leisure?
It's based on what a 40-hour work week would be. Each one of these metrics, by the way, and anyone who's listening can go to the DNR website, the Department of Natural Resources website in Maryland, and click on, you can even just Google GPI Maryland, and you can see and look at what the metrics are for each of these that we're talking about. So when you click on that, you'll see that that's based on a 40-hour work week, approximately how much vacation should you normally get, and how much are you actually getting. And a great example would be, how about our lower-income individuals who are working 2 to 3 jobs to make ends meet? There's
no leisure time.
No leisure time.
Right.
None. And so what is the cost to society for that person not getting time off?
Who figures that one out?
That's
a state agency does that?
That's right. And these are makes this apolitical, because these are metrics that are already out there that you and I could gather.
These are metrics that the state is already collecting?
Already has out
there. So in order to put the Maryland Genuine Progress Indicator into action, did not really cost the state much money to do this?
No, it didn't.
Okay.
It didn't.
It's not like there's a big staff. You're saying this data is already available. Mm-hmm. You just have to find it and bring it together. Okay.
And what's really, and this is funny, going back to the cost of crime, that's where my TED Talk comes into this being here, is that I was hit by a drunk hit-and-run driver.
On your bicycle?
Fortunately, in my car.
In your car.
So fortunately, I was not injured, but my car was damaged.
Because I know you're a biker.
I'm very much a cyclist. That's right. And fortunately, I was not on my bike, so I was not hurt. But the bottom line was is that that fellow, that Jim, who was the hit-and-run drunk driver, ended up contributing to our economy hugely. because think about this. He employed police officers, a towing company, insurance companies, right? The jail. He spent 15 days in jail. All of that added to our GDP. I would say none of that added to our quality of life. And that's why it's a negative. But the GDP counts it as a positive.
Really?
Yes. In fact, hurricanes.
Yeah, right, because that's the work of the police. It's the work of the ambulance driver. Right. It's the work of the jail that had to take care of him for how many days?
15 days. And it's worse than that. He injured his knee. He had to have a knee replacement because of the accident and because he crashed into a pole. So that means more work for the hospital staff, for the surgeons.
So how does GPI calculate for that? Use that same example for
us. It subtracts all that back out. So what it basically says, here's our GDP, which has been rising dramatically, actually, since the 1950s. It then subtracts out all these negative things that we just talked about and comes up with a quality of life index, our GPI.
Let's go to environmental indicators. I think this is pretty interesting, and our listeners probably want to know what goes into this. This is again, Greg Cantore, ahead of his talk on Friday, his TEDx talk, Baltimore, telling us about, giving a preview of what he's going to be talking about on Friday. He's suggesting that instead of using the gross domestic product, GDP, that the nation ought to be measuring its well-being based on the genuine progress indicator. And here's the Maryland version of it. Mm-hmm. Under environmental indicators, we have the cost of water pollution, the cost of air pollution, the cost of noise pollution, the cost of net wetlands change. I mean, loss of wetlands mm-hmm. in the state, the cost of net farmland change, farmland turning over to whatever, development of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
Cost of net forest cover change, loss of forest cover, or it could be a plus, right? In some years.
Exactly.
Maybe, I don't know.
When we do remediation plantings and so on.
Again, this is all information culled from the state's own agencies that measure these things.
That's right. That's right. So all this data is already out there. And one of the concerns that I've always had, and when I was an affordable housing developer running Light Street Housing with the homeless many years ago, we had indicators for vacant houses, for instance, is that how many vacant houses were there? How many were we converting back to usable homes? Obviously, indicators like how many people are ill-housed, affordably housed, and so on, safely housed. All these were indicators. And you can really get into the math of all of this, but keeping this at a very high level, what we're really talking about is ways to hold ourselves and others accountable to taking action. And in my long-term vision and dream for all of this is that when we hear a State of the Union address, that we hear about what our quality of life index is doing. And it's based on all of these metrics.
It has a deeper meaning than the GDP.
Much deeper.
Right? And it may not be as positive in some years. Even years when there's economic growth, substantial economic growth, there may be things that pull us back. There may be a cost to the growth.
You got it. And let's use China as a great example. Huge economic growth there, right? And we're in Beijing and Shanghai. Sometimes you can't see across the street.
Right. A great environmental cost.
That's right.
On the economic indicators column here, personal consumption expenditures. So what are we spending? That's part of GDP now, right?
That's right.
Income inequality. Now,
that's a hot topic.
Yeah, yeah. So how is that measured?
Well, it shows that the disparity between high and higher income and lower income, the greater that disparity occurs, it means that the per dollar value added benefits the lower income individuals less than it does the higher income. Look at the calculation on there.
It
is on there, and it's actually a well-accepted calculation, too, and how they come up with inequality calculations.
Is that the state? Does the state do that calculation?
Federal government does.
The Census Bureau has it. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Adjusted personal consumption, services of consumer durables.
That's right. A good example there being is that when we buy our refrigerator or stove, the GDP just counts it in the year that we actually purchase it. The truth is it has a lifespan, 15, maybe 20 years. So it's providing services throughout its lifespan. So you need to actually add that back. It's actually a plus.
Another one that goes into this calculus, cost of underemployment. How do they measure that one?
Big one. I actually haven't gone into that metric in detail yet.
Okay.
And actually, Dan, what I'll be doing is blogging about each of these in great detail. I'll talk about the where the metric came from, who's behind that, what the data is behind that, where we stand right now, and also the nonprofits and the government and for-profit sectors, what we're doing about making that metric better.
Greg, is there a push nationally, internationally, to get the GPI used by governments?
Yes. Actually, Vermont, by state legislation, has adopted the GPI. So it's in there, and they're going to start using it as a fiscal note, meaning that when a bill is passed and there's a cost associated with that legislation, they're going to be looking at it through the lens of a GPI.
It's interesting. I mean, yeah. It's if you take the time to understand what goes into it, which we just did, mm-hmm. I hope, for our listeners, it does give you just a better sense of where we are, what the mm-hmm. reality is versus just economic productivity.
That's right. It's really comprehensive, and it reflects the complexity of our lives. And that's what's so exciting about this. And Dan, a lot of the stories and work you've done with other visitors here, they have talked about how they have improved quality of life. But we haven't been able to do it in a comprehensive way that this allows us. And imagine, so just imagine, you know, a couple of years from now, we can say, and because of the work that I do at XYZ nonprofit, we've seen an indication of an increase here in these people's quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So is this your crusade in semi-retirement, Greg Cantore?
It is. It really is. Oh. It is. This hit me right between the eyes, and actually Jim, the drunk driver, was a great beneficiary of that because it really hit me. And this is that collisions aspect of the TED conference that truly was a collision that brought this to
wow. Bear. So you're using that theme too,
literally.
Which is the theme of the
literally.
Conference, collisions. Yeah, it's Friday at Morgan State University. I ought to just mention here, Friday, it's from 9:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. Of course, at TEDx Baltimore, an all-day event. There will be 16 speakers. Julia, who was just here, and Greg are two of them. We'll be meeting a third speaker in just a moment. General admission, $40, students, $15, and you can find a link to the TEDx Baltimore website on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. By the way, how do you practice for a TED Talk?
Over and over again.
Do you do it in front of a mirror? Do you do it in front of a family member?
All the above.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's over and over and over again. It's a little nerve-wracking because we have to get a lot of information into less than 15 minutes.
Right. And you get to use a PowerPoint or something?
If you want to.
Yeah.
I'll be PowerPoint-less.
Right.
So I'll be using my hands in the air.
Well, Greg, this is very interesting. Thanks for coming in to explain it.
I
hadn't heard of the GPI before
sure.
you came along here.
And
you.
You're very welcome. If anyone wants to learn more about this, go to the website. Also, Maryland Nonprofits has a conference coming up, a summit. It's the very first summit to talk about how the GPI and our quality of life can work when we bring all the sectors together. It's on March 24th.
Oh, one last question. You mentioned the former Governor O'Malley had adopted the GPI, mm-hmm. I guess by executive order or mm-hmm. something. So what? How does it get to the status Vermont has in Maryland?
It eventually will probably need some legislation passed to have it be used as an actual legislative note.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you going to work on that too?
Yeah, I hope so.
Okay. Thank you, Greg Cantore. We'll continue our conversation about the TEDx talks coming up this weekend. Another TEDx speaker will be joining us, Shanaysha Sahls, chair of the Baltimore City School Board, who'll be talking about breathing new life into the public school system in her TEDx talk. And we get to hear a little bit of it after this short break on the Midday Show. What if Star Wars had never been made? It's hard to imagine the pop culture landscape without Darth Vader, Princess Leia, and Yoda. But George Lucas actually had a tough time getting a film studio to take a chance on his science fiction epic. How Star Wars Conquered the Universe. Some film history with Chris Taylor of Mashable on Midday after the news at 1. Yes, welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Speaking to some of the speakers at the TEDx, TEDx Baltimore this Friday, Shanaysha Sahls is up next, chairwoman of the Baltimore City School Board. She'll be giving a talk on Friday on how to breathe innovation in the public school system to bridge the opportunity gap that exists in so many of our cities for young people. Shanaysha Sahls, nice to have you on the show.
Oh, great. Thanks for having me.
So the theme of the TEDx is collisions, and two of our guests so far, Julia and Greg, are using that as a way to step into their TED Talk, this the idea of collisions. Are you using that? Because apparently you're not required to, but are you?
Yeah, I mean, it's animating the spirit of the talk. I mean, there's a sense that there are sort of two separate universes that touch all of our lives. One universe is the educational universe, the educational organizations that touch the lives of society, that produce creativity, opportunity, and happiness when they are performing at their highest levels. And then we have our economies, right, that are also domains for the exercise and the realization of opportunity, of happiness, and creativity. Yet they don't really speak to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And there's sort of this sort of false set of assumptions about what drives them and what they're about. And I want not only to collide those two worlds, but to merge them and blur the lines. Because I think that is going to be the key for opening up opportunity, happiness, and creativity for society and for students and families that just don't have access to them.
I get that. Now, what's this idea about seeing the public schools, or what if public schools had to work in the way startups do? That question. I see that you wrestle with that question a little bit.
Right. I mean, if you think about how we think about educational organizations or systems, we don't tend to think of them as having a startup mentality. We think about them in terms of how comprehensive they are, how directive they are, how top-down, highly administrative, about structures and processes. But, you know, the argument would be that educational organizations and educational systems have as much of a reason, if not more of a reason, to be innovative and have a startup mentality. And I think that we're in this moment in history, certainly in the 21st century, where our economy is defined by innovation, right? We say that we live in a knowledge economy. And the knowledge economy is an economy that's unique because not only is it driven by information and knowledge, but it's using information and knowledge in order to meet societal wants and needs. And what do we want and need more than opportunity? And so I really see this opportunity for, sorry to be redundant, for education and a knowledge economy to use their mutual assets to work together to improve the lives of society.
I get you. I think that's neat. But some people would say, well, there's been too much innovation in education. You know, Common Core this year, No Child Left Behind, Once Upon a Time, or some other innovation, some bringing technology into the classroom. Wait a minute. It's too much. We're not doing the basics very well. What about that?
Right. So it's a great criticism, right? Because these things end up being episodic, blips on the radar, easily absorbed.
Trends.
And that's precisely sort of the shorthand for how we think about sort of the startup culture. But if we think about what education needs to do and what our society needs, if we think about an economy that needs informed, creative, capable, and kind citizens, consumers, and a workforce, and an educational system that's supposed to be designed to produce good citizens, good entrepreneurs, a good workforce, we have to figure out a way to blend the lines and not to think, okay, well, this is another new thing, like, quote unquote, the Common Core or Race to the Top. And so the way that I'm envisioning this collision is that we merge the distinction between education as a public sector and business as a private sector to figure out how their collective assets can work together to solve three major problems that we see every day. One major problem is that we have a real issue with sort of this question of college and career readiness, which has become the tagline, and what's happening in our high schools. So how do we get both the private sector and the educational sector to lean in, collide in meaningful ways, right? So what are the new possibilities? You have in stadiums, college stadiums across the country, where you have these naming opportunities. What are the naming and sponsorship opportunities for the private sector, for businesses to adopt, not just for branding purposes, but to repurpose, to reprogram what happens in our high school? Imagine an Under Armour high school, right?
I was just going to say Under Armour. Okay. If you take Under Armour, help us imagine that then. Because some people would say, well, wait a minute. I don't want corporations' grip on my public school.
Of course not. But that's not the way we should think about it.
Not think about it as a grip.
We think about it in terms of how are we going to engage students and engage the staff within those schools to want to be in school, want to learn, right? And so if you think about the example of Under Armour, right, and that's very local, Under Armour is not only a brand, it's sort of a way of life, right? It's not only, you're not only purchasing a symbol, right? You're purchasing a kind of a swag, right? There's sort of a substance that sort of emanates from what it means to buy and wear Under Armour. So what then does that mean for how you program a school? right? What does that mean for the culture of the school? What does that mean how you train staff? What does that mean in terms of how you develop your staff, how you recruit the people there, and then what you're teaching your students to do and to aspire towards?
So you're not just training them to go to work for Under Armour.
No, not at all. Not at all. You use these opportunities for whether it's Under Armour, it's parks and people, outdoor living classroom, it's the Great Kids Farm or the City Farm Cooperative Learning Center, it's the GoDaddy CTE track. I mean, the founder of GoDaddy is an alumnus of Baltimore City Public Schools, right? I mean, we're talking about ramping up CTE and really making people college and career ready. What if we called in GoDaddy to design the CTE track around website development and technology?
Okay, website, you just said right. It. Website design and technology. Okay.
And what's important
about
this concept?
I like this. So what do you say to people who say these are defenders of liberal arts education at the college level? Say, okay, I understand we've got to make kids ready to go to work. We understand that, but there's Shakespeare and there's Voltaire and there's all
wonderful.
There's all this too. You can't just leave that out and just have kids on a conveyor belt going from high school through a college getting a technical education for some job they may not even like. I don't know.
No, actually, it's a great observation and potential criticism. So I am the product of a liberal arts education. My PhD is in political philosophy. I taught Shakespeare as a high school teacher as well as world literature. So it is the concern is resonant on many levels. I think that we can design our experiences at the K-12 level, and even at the college and university level, such that we're not taking away from the liberal arts. I chose a liberal arts track in my higher educational career. However, that's not going to be the track for everyone, right? And so you can still teach Shakespeare. You can still teach Chinua Achebe, right? You can still teach Arundhati Roy. You can still teach sort of the great works, not only the canonical works, but the works that are sort of pressing on our thinking, but also provide pathways for the fact that not everyone is going to make a living using the text of the Federalist Papers, which is how I made my living for quite some time. So these two strivings are not mutually exclusive, and there's always going to be a place for the liberal arts and sciences. There's always going to be a place for the high schools that focus on the track of the liberal arts and sciences. But we recognize that what makes an economy successful is having multiple pathways to success. They're not narrow pathways to success. They're multiple pathways to success. And what we need in our workforce are people who have the flexibility of mind and the good, hard, and soft skills to be successful. Whether they are working for Constellation Energy, they're working for Under Armour, they're working for GoDaddy, they're working for Boeing, they're working so on and so forth, or they're working in the nonprofit sector. It takes all types, and we need to make sure that the educational system is designed to absorb and to properly educate all kinds of people so they can be successful on the paths that they select.
Shanesha Sauls is chair of the Baltimore City School Board, one of the featured speakers, one of 16 speakers in TEDx Baltimore this Friday at Morgan State. So the public schools, when you say they need to think like startups or behave like startups, meaning there needs to be this spirit of innovation in how we approach our schools and how the schools function,
yes,
how they respond.
Yes, but I want to be careful here because I think there's mutual learning, right? I mean, often the trope is that the public school system or educational organizations have a lot to learn from the private sector,
right,
with the assumption that the private sector does it best or better. That's
right.
Actually not always the case. The claim that I'm making is that both universes, right now we see them as different universes, have something to teach each other, right? I mean, if you think about it, educational systems interface with all walks of life. They literally take everyone. Right. And it is their task and it is their mission to take whomever comes to their doors and transform them into something better. Right. And they figure out ways to do it. Markets don't necessarily have to behave in that way. Right. So there's some mutual learning that has to take place. And so I don't want us to fall into sort of potentially dismissive arguments where we assume that, the educational system is down here, business is up here. And so we're going to sort of condescend to help the educational system.
Mm-hmm.
That's precisely the wrong way to approach it.
So how do you envision this collision of the two? Because the school system has the infrastructure. You know, they actually have the buildings and the teachers and the desks. And, it's the public school system. How does Under Armour besides putting its name or its, you said it wasn't for branding purposes, bringing its spirit to a school. What do they bring?
What does the school system bring?
No. What does the private sector bring? In this case, Under Armour. What do they bring to, say, a particular school that they, I don't know, adopt, embrace, whatever the word is?
Right. I think it brings the carrot. It brings the carrot, right? So you have students who need to be reengaged, and teachers and staff who want to engage with their students in new and interesting ways. So they bring first of all, sort of an aspiration that it may be Under Armour or something else. They also sort of bring a sense of what makes their particular organization tick and what makes their particular organization successful. So, and you think about that in terms of not only in terms of how people relate to one another, but also how we're creating environment so that people want to do the work and want to work together, right? I mean, it could be changing pedagogy, right? It could be changing sort of being less sort of lecture-centered and teacher-centered and working in teams. Right. So imagine by your senior year at every single school that has these either university assisted or private sector assisted or foundation assisted schools, by your senior year, you're working on a series of challenges appropriate to whatever their curriculum is. Maybe it is doing community art. Right. And you're learning to work with other people, taking a concept from being a nebulous, ambiguous idea and actually executing on it in concrete ways. And you're having teachers who are educators, but you also have professionals in the world of work guiding, mentoring and judging your ability to succeed. I mean, those are the way. I mean, we just have to think differently. And I think that our standards and our expectations must be high, and they certainly have some room to go to be higher, but they're also elastic enough so they can conform to making sure that students are prepared for the world they're going to encounter.
What observations as chair of the city school board would you make or could you make so that I understand what got you to this? Because there must have been things that came up, issues that have come up that got you thinking this way.
So I should say that I have the honor of serving as the chair of the school board. However, I'm speaking as Shanaisha Sauls, and so my role on the school board is one part of the culmination of where I stand today. It is not the sum total. And so I think that to be fair and I think circumspect, while it has certainly informed my thinking, I do not represent the Baltimore City school system. However, that said, I do think that there have been a tremendous amount of activity within the school system that suggests to me that there's a lot of potential here and that we all just need to lean in, right? So we need to sort of put our assets on the table and figure out how we are able to better confront constrained capacity from everyone in order to knit our assets together so that we can work well together. So that's the only thing I can say about sort of how my specific experience on the school board lends itself, because I want to make sure that I'm clear that Shanaisha Sauls is giving a TEDx talk, certainly not the Baltimore City Public School
that.
System.
I get that. Well, you know, we frequently hear about workforce readiness in the Baltimore area, especially when economists or business leaders are talking about the region's readiness to expand for the economy to grow, whether we have enough, you know, capable people living here who can do the jobs of the 21st century.
And they can do the jobs. I mean, that is what I think is so energizing and maddening at the same time. You know, you walk into any school. I mean, you roll a dice, you walk into school X, and you look into the faces of the students who are there. And while it is certainly true that they come with a lot in terms of context, spend any amount of time in a school and tell me that given the right conditions, the right circumstances, the right incentives, and the right sense of aspirations that are actually attainable, right? You don't hold up a picture to them and then put a glass wall that can't be shattered. I mean, you can set this up so that we can unlock those opportunities, because the human capital is here. We have to figure out a way to unlock it and push it out and not be afraid of what that means, even if it means colliding into universes that don't make us feel comfortable. No one should feel comfortable.
I like this, Shanaisha. Shanaisha Sauls is chairwoman of the Baltimore City School Boards, but one of the featured speakers at the TEDx conference, the TEDx Baltimore event on Friday at Morgan State University. It runs from 9:30 to 6 p.m., and you can get information about it at tedxbaltimore.com, also on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Well, that sounds pretty good to me. Thank you very much for being here, Shanae. You should give our listeners a taste of what you'll be saying, what we're talking about on Friday.
Thank you.
Thank you, yeah. We're going to take a break here for lunch, as we always do on Tuesday, from Bagby Pizza Company, located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East. The Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven thin crust pizza, sandwiches, pastas, salads, and more, fresh daily. Bagby Pizza is open 11 a.m. to 9 p.m., and they have delivery 5 to 9 p.m. Please stay tuned for the news and then the second hour of our show.
There's another hour of Midday with Dan Rodrick's yet to come here on your NPR news station, WYPR. Then stay with us at 2 o'clock for Here and Now.
I'm Lisa Mullins. Pope Francis has shaken up church orthodoxy. Will the church's view on women be next?
It's theologically untenable. It's psychologically ridiculous. And it's scientifically totally bizarre and bankrupt.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, this afternoon at 2, here on your public radio. Then stay tuned for Fresh Air, this afternoon at 3, where we take a look at the early days of the Beatles. We'll talk with the executive producer of a new collection of Beatles performances on the BBC. That's this afternoon at 3 on Fresh Air. Then stay tuned at 4 for All Things Considered.
Football helped Corey Parker escape a rough Detroit neighborhood. Now he's helping high school players as their coach.
When I got here, you had so many guys that made a decision to be the thug. And they always played and started here. I said, I'm going to change all of that.
That story and the latest on the Northeast blizzard today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Catch All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 until 6:30 here on your public radio. And we invite you to join the senior host of All Things Considered, Robert Siegel, when he comes to Baltimore for an event at MICA. It's Tuesday, February 3rd. That's Tuesday of next week. Tickets and information about the 6:30 p.m. reception and 7:30 p.m. event may be found online at robertsiegel.eventbrite.com. Our Evening with Robert Siegel is made possible in part by iCandy Opticianry. Programming today is made possible by Creative City Public Charter School, a progressive elementary school in Northwest Baltimore where students use the arts and hands-on projects to connect with nature and their community. Accepting applications for grades K through 4 for next school year. Lottery deadline February 6th. CreativeCitySchool.org. You're tuned to Your Public Radio, WYPR and WYPR HD1 Baltimore, WYPF Frederick, WYPO Ocean City, and online, WYPR.org. It's 1 o'clock.
The first Star Wars movie opened 38 years ago, but its influence on pop culture and filmmaking still loom large. From action figures to video games, the franchise is said to be worth $40 billion. There have been 6 episodes, with a 7th, the start of another trilogy, due out later this year. Chris Taylor, deputy editor of the news website Mashable, joins us to explain how Star Wars conquered the entertainment universe, how George Lucas went from film student to blockbuster director. Star Wars, the past, present, and future of a multi-billion-dollar franchise, after the news.